Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Harper government has approved the controversial Northern Gateway Pipeline, but it's attached 209 conditions. Environmentalists, First Nations, and many British Columbians are upset over the decision. To look at both sides of this issue, we have a representative from Enbridge and NDP MP Nathan Cullen.
Fresh off a surprise election victory, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne sits down with us to discuss her majority victory, the scandals that have plagued the provincial grits, and the challenges she faces moving forward.
Speaking of Ontario, it's apparently being shortchanged by the feds to the tune of $1.2 billion. That's according to a report by the Parliamentary Budget Officer, which examined changes to the provincial transfer program. To explain the numbers, we're joined by the Assistant PBO.
And the House of Commons has risen for the summer. The McLean's panel takes a look back at the highlights and lowlights of the spring session and considers what's to come in the months ahead.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, the Harper government gave the green light to the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The project would pump crude from the Alberta oil sands to the northern BC coast with the aim of exporting our energy to Asian nations. But the approval was instantly criticized by environmentalists and Aboriginal groups who have been fighting the project because of the risks to the environment and the apparent lack of consultations with First Nations.
Despite the criticism, Prime Minister Stephen Harper defends the decision.
The government is acting on the advice of an independent scientific panel that thoroughly reviewed these matters. The government has applied the conditions that demanded by that panel. It is now up to the proponent to assure the regulator going forward that it will indeed comply with those conditions.
This thumbs up does not mean shovels will be in the ground right away. The Harper government has agreed with an independent review panel to attach 209 conditions that have to be completed by Enbridge, the company building the pipeline.
We'll talk about the political reaction in a moment, but first I'm joined by Darcy Levesque, VP of Enterprise Communications for Enbridge. He's called in from Calgary.
I'm glad to be here.
What's your reaction to the approval, and when do you expect to meet all of these conditions that have been laid out for you?
Well, first of all, Enbridge and our Northern Gateway funding partners welcome the federal decision. I think it's important for folks to understand that this decision builds on the positive recommendation made by the Regulatory Joint Review Panel in December of last year, and that panel, following the review of 175,000 pages of evidence and 180 days of hearings, which included over 80 expert witnesses, concluded that this project could be built and operated safely and that ultimately Northern Gateway was in the national interest.
There are some court challenges, though, that have been launched.
We're not surprised that there are a number of court challenges. However, we've taken that into consideration. We don't believe that they are insurmountable. Clearly, we prefer to resolve conflict through meaningful dialogue, but at the end of the day, we don't believe that those challenges ultimately are insurmountable or will impact the timing of the project.
So you don't think there's going to be delays thanks to this court challenge? Because a lot of people launching the court challenges say they're going to hold this project up for years and years.
I know that a number of project proponents have suggested that court challenges have the ability to delay the project indefinitely. That's certainly not our view, and I think that we've taken legal challenges into consideration in our planning and in our timing.
What about the BC government? I mean, Premier Christy Clark says this project has not met the five conditions that she has laid out for not just the company but the government overall for this project.
Well, first of all, we've always believed that the five conditions that Premier Clark's government has established will ultimately help us build a world-class project. With respect to the five conditions, we've actually met the first condition, which was to receive a approval on the former environmental and regulatory review. Clearly, we have more work to do, and we are diligently working with our engineers and our scientists and other experts to identify how we can best meet the other four conditions.
Is Enbridge willing to pay up to the BC government? I mean, one of the things that the BC government wants is their fair share of royalties from this, and it doesn't appear like the Alberta government is willing to give in to that. So, I mean, what is the solution there?
We believe that this project will bring significant and lasting economic benefits to British Columbia and, for that matter, Canada. For example, the project will create over 1,100 permanent, well-paying jobs. 560 of those jobs are in BC alone. So that, think about it, that's 560 BC families whose livelihood will depend to some degree on this project. In addition to that, the BC government will earn billions of dollars in revenue from taxes, both directly and indirectly.
But with royalties being between governments and separate than the economic benefits, are you working actively between both the Alberta and BC governments to try and come to some sort of solution on this issue?
We're committed to working with all levels of government if we in turn can help create a receptive environment for this project to proceed. So ultimately, many of these discussions have to be between governments. It's not up to Enbridge to have discussions around royalties. That's between governments.
You talked earlier in the interview about dialogue and solving problems through dialogue, and that's one of the big issues and challenges facing this project right now. Aboriginal groups who are challenging this legally, they have serious environmental concerns. Some are saying, you know, there's simply not enough consultation. Did the company not address these matters properly with First Nations before this point?
From day one, Cormac, we've been very committed to engaging respectfully with Aboriginal communities along the right-of-way. In fact, our track record would suggest that we've had over 2,000 meetings and over 43 open houses with potentially affected First Nation communities and Métis communities. This has resulted in, to date, us entering into 26 equity agreements. These are First Nation and Aboriginal communities who have entered into commercial agreements to become equity partners or commercial partners in this project. But clearly, we agree with the federal government that we have more work to do, which is why in December of last year, following the positive recommendation from the Joint Review Panel, we committed to re-engaging with those First Nations that we have yet to earn their trust and confidence.
Legally, the duty to consult with First Nations on projects like this lies with the federal government, with the Crown. But the government is telling you to consult more. So if legally it's the federal government's job to consult over a process that they have the ultimate right to approve or not, are you being left out to dry here? Is the buck being passed to the company?
Well, we believe that, you know, I'm not saying that we have completed our consultation. In fact, if anything, we believe that consultation is ultimately an ongoing process. That said, clearly the Crown does have a duty to consult. I believe the federal government remains committed to that process. I personally believe that it's a somewhat of a shared responsibility. We need to do our part, and we will rely on the federal government to do their part.
Could it be a sticking point, a legal sticking point, though?
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't want to speculate on legal outcomes. As I said, all that we can do as a company and as the project proponent is remain committed to trying to sit down and have meaningful dialogue with First Nations.
The environmentalist argument out of all of this is that not only, you know, would there be large carbon footprint from the oil sands anyway, but also there's a risk of an oil spill from this pipeline.
Well, our goal from day one has been to ensure that oil never meets water, which is why we have basically put forward a project that has incorporated the best and possible world-leading standards in terms of protecting the environment and marine safety. In fact, we believe that our project will actually raise the bar for marine safety, not only for our project, but for other traffic on the entire West Coast.
It's not just the coastline and the water, it's also forestry. This will be going through the Rocky Mountains.
Sure. No, clearly this project covers a lot of land. I think something that many people don't understand is we've made significant changes and improvements to the project, which we think will actually safeguard the environment. One of those measures is the fact that over 70% of the proposed right-of-way will use previously disturbed land. That means that we are trying to, whenever possible, avoid impacting any kind of pristine land and forest. I think the fact that we're going out of our way to try to mitigate and limit our environmental impact speaks well of the project and our commitment to raising the bar on both marine and land safety.
There are environmentalists and First Nations groups who say they will lie down in front of bulldozers if they have to stop this project. Is your company worried about civil disobedience if construction begins?
Well, we're not proposing to put shovels in the ground tomorrow. We're taking a very measured and prudent approach. Ultimately, we don't believe that civil disobedience is a way to resolve differences. We believe that civil disobedience promotes conflict rather than conversation. So we remain committed to trying to resolve differences through dialogue.
Referendums say this pipeline shouldn't be built. The provincial government seems to be actively working against the project. Environmentalists, mm-hmm. First Nations are against the pipeline and trying to challenge it legally. And even some BC Conservative MPs with the government, not all of them, but some of them, have been using the phrase, if it ever gets built. You have a lot of challenges ahead of you, which you have acknowledged, but can you say for sure that this project is going to be built?
Well, as I said, ultimately, we have a lot of work to do before we even make that decision in terms of going forward. We remain confident that this project can be built. I think when you're talking about public opinion, it's important to understand that suggestions by our opponents that everyone is against this project is simply not true. And we remain confident that this project will be built. And in fact, again, independent polls, most of them, including the Angus Reid poll this week, says that a majority of Canadians believe it will be built. So, yes, Gateway is controversial, and yes, we do face some opposition, and we've got to work hard to overcome that. But at the end of the day, this is not unexpected, and I think we're seeing that given concerns over climate change and the environment and oil sands development, I think we're seeing that all oil pipeline projects and energy infrastructure projects continue to face opposition from some quarters.
That was Darcy Levesque with Enbridge, the company building the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
With this approval, Conservative MPs from British Columbia like Mark Warwa say they've been hearing from a lot of their constituents who either hate or support the pipeline.
I've had some letters and I've had and comments, phone calls, emails, but correspondence is pretty equal right now.
And could you give us numbers of how much reaction you got since last night?
I've had a lot of tweets from people and I don't know where they live, but... A lot of them inappropriate.
New Democrat MP Nathan Cullen is one of those British Columbians who isn't happy right now. This pipeline goes right through his riding, and he joins me on the phone from BC. So Nathan, thanks for joining us. Obviously, the NDP is very concerned about the Northern Gateway project and has obviously stated those concerns this week. With the government giving it a conditional approval this week, and obviously the debate now, I assume, ramping up, where do you see this going?
Well, the project doesn't go anywhere from here. I'm sure the company will start doing some things, but from a British Columbia perspective, certainly in the Northwest where I live, the conversation has been so poisoned. The company has so little trust, and that is only surpassed by the amount of mistrust for the government and the role that the Conservatives have played in this. Obviously, they're not feeling so proud about it either, as you saw with the way the announcement was done and different aspects of how the government has portrayed this is not their responsibility when it was entirely their doing. There's a lot of uncertainty, and my worry is certainly for broader questions about industrial resource development in BC, because there's anytime you have so soured a relationship, particularly with First Nations, it causes ripple effects. So where does the project go? It goes into the courts. Obviously, there'll be a significant number of lawsuits lining up of some substance. Nothing positive, I don't think, in the next short while, certainly, for anybody, really.
Is it your hope that public opinion can have a major impact here still, that even though there is this conditional approval and there are these conditions that the company now needs to try to meet, do you still think that there's some chance that public opinion can play a role in this still?
I think there's no doubt public opinion will continue to play a role. That's the exact reason why the Conservatives are trying to distance themselves from their own works here. The fact is that as the company and the Conservatives have tried to say, well, this is just inevitable, so whether you like it or not, just accept it. In British Columbia, that's not the best argument to use, just based on even recent experience with government imposing the HST in a very terrible process against the wishes of British Columbians. That was inevitable. That was law. That was already imposed. And because of the peculiarities of the BC political economy, it was able to be reversed. And I don't think this decision is surprising to anybody. I think it's certainly disappointing. But all of that to say that the voices of British Columbians will still be counted at the end of the day. There's just no way to shut them out. And that means at the polls as well, because conservatives are obviously very exposed with the 21 seats they have in BC, which they need to maintain and grow in order to keep government. All of that has been put at risk because of their belligerence on this one bad pipeline.
In a way, though, isn't this the way it's supposed to work? A project goes to the National Energy Board, it's considered, conditions are put on it. You know, an independent panel makes, you know, a recommendation, and the government decides whether or not to go with that recommendation. Like,
the conservatives put their hand on one side of the scale right from before the start, before a single word was spoken at any hearings. The government then changed the law retroactively around the NEB, this so-called independent body. So with the Prime Minister making his intentions more than clear, with the government taking the decision and the power away from the NEB, the inevitability of the Conservatives saying yes to this thing, regardless of what the NEB heard or said, was set from the beginning, from before the beginning. So no, this isn't how it's meant to work. Governments are not meant to skew the process. And what it's done is poison the well on community consultation in general, that so many thousands of British Columbians got engaged, poured their hearts out, did what citizens are supposed to do and voiced their opinions, and had all of those opinions entirely ignored. I've never seen, I think there were two or three witnesses and people writing in out of the somewhat 10, 11,000 people. It's ridiculous that the NEB had some passing mention of opposition to this thing. So the First Nations rights and title, the government, conservatives still seem to ignore the reality, and the reality is they can't privatize consultation with First Nations. It is the responsibility of the government. And I don't know. They just don't seem to have learned. And that's the most surprising thing out of all this.
Do you specifically question the findings of the NEB, the conclusions the NEB came to?
The NEB gave a green light to this without any spill plan in place. The NEB came to the conclusion that this was a safe project without understanding the qualities of bitumen when it gets in water. I just don't know how you can say, judge whether something is safe or not when its most essential properties are not yet understood. And the federal government refused to do any testing, refused to have any real-world experience. And I think in part because we know the qualities of diluted bitumen in water. It sinks. It's impossible to clean up. And so when you see something so fundamental, that just at the very heart of the conversation you're having, not get answered, purposely get ignored, it leads one to suspect the entire process and the validity of it. And Lord knows I asked. I was an intervener on this process. I asked the federal government, I asked Enbridge to talk to me about how cleanup would be done, how bitumen works in water. It's just fundamental. I don't know if you'd go buy a car with no knowing whether the brakes work or not, but that's essentially what just happened. Just crossing your fingers and hoping everything will be okay is not exactly reassuring for the people in the northwest of British Columbia.
On the larger issue of oil exports and mm-hmm. building a pipeline to the West Coast, does the NDP oppose any proposal to build a pipeline to the West Coast? Are you steadfast against that entirely?
No, not at all. Yeah, there's some principles we hold, and we think principles are important in politics. One is that we add as much value to the resource. That's something that not just we believe, but Premier Lougheed used to believe, Jim Prentice believed. We haven't built a refinery upgrade in this country in a generation. People talk about how much money we're losing because of the lower value of oil received in the North American market. That's true. We're losing much, much more of the value of a barrel of oil because we don't upgrade or refine it. The second quality and important principle is that First Nations are involved and consultated and accommodated. That's not just a principle. That's actually the law. And we think following the law is a good idea in most cases. So why, for heaven's sakes, wouldn't the government hold that? And the last thing is about that protection and that basic balancing of environmental concerns. And this government not only changed the laws around the NEB, but gutted the Fisheries Act, ripped the environmental assessment to almost nothing, and skewered every law they could find that would put any scrutiny to the development of oil pipelines. All of that lowers the public confidence, by the way, not only gives approvals that are too low a threshold and too low a standard.
That was NDP MP Nathan Cullen discussing the Northern Gateway Pipeline. For more on this controversial project, go to macleans.ca.
Coming up, we sit down with Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne after her surprise victory in the provincial election. We look at a report that says some provinces are being shortchanged by the federal equalization program, and the Macleans panel takes a look back at the spring session of Parliament. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we take a look at why some provinces are being shortchanged and others are cashing in from the Federal Equalization Program. The McLean's panel reviews the spring sitting of Parliament, and Nick Taylor-Vasey reviews all the action during the last week in the House of Commons.
Just over a week ago, the Ontario Liberals won a majority government in the provincial election after a campaign filled with speculation the Grits may be tossed from office. The poll showed the possibility of a progressive conservative government following a string of Liberal scandals from the Dalton-McGuinty years. But after the ballots were cast, the Grits grabbed 58 seats in the Ontario legislature, while the Tories have 28 and the New Democrats have 21.
This week, McLean senior correspondent Jonathan Gatehouse was able to sit down with Premier Wynne to discuss the vote, the scandals, and the challenges she's facing as she returns to Queen's Park.
You seem surprised by your majority victory on election night. Why? Were your polls wrong too?
I think I was more pleased than surprised. But, you know, we hadn't known, obviously, where we were going to land. And there were polls all over the place, as you know. You could have picked a poll where we were going to lose. You could have picked a poll where we were going to have a majority and everything in between. So I never count on anything, you know. I never take anything for granted.
It was a campaign of stark choices. You were promising a lot of government stimulus. The Tories were promising austerity. So what message do you take away from the majority?
I think that people looked at, as you say, some very stark choices. They looked at some very clear differences, different plans that were being put forward by Tim Hudak and by me, and they chose the plan that was going to invest in them. You know, they saw themselves, I believe, reflected in our plan, whether it's in the transit and transportation infrastructure that they need in their communities, or whether it's in a retirement pension plan that they know that they or their children or grandchildren need. They saw themselves reflected in the concerns and the investments that we were talking about. And I think that is, I can only take from the majority victory that's what they want to see implemented.
At the same time, turnout was 52% of eligible.
Up 3 or 4 points, yeah.
Given. And I think the early results had you winning with about 38.5%, 38.6% of the vote. So isn't there a message there too? I mean, are Ontarians turned off by their provincial politics?
Well, as they say, there was an increase in voter turnout. So, you know, maybe it wasn't a huge increase, but there was an increase in voter turnout. I'm going to take that as a positive sign that people were engaged. But look, the issues around voter turnout are something that we need to deal with in a much broader way. You know, it's not just about Ontario. It's not just about this election. We need to ask ourselves why people are not more engaged in politics nationally, provincially, and municipally. And we need to turn our minds to how to get more people involved, particularly young people.
The polls, if we believe them, had indicated prior to the election, even during the election, that something in the neighborhood of 60%+ of people in this province thought that the Liberals deserved to lose. What do you have to do to change that perception?
The election campaign went some way to doing that, but I am under no illusion that I don't have to continue to earn the trust of the people of the province. And you know, the way I have to do that is to be very upfront with them as we implement our plan, the plan that we ran on. That is my commitment. I have committed to openness. I've committed to doing what I said that I was going to do and telling people how it's going. And that's what I will do.
What mistakes did your predecessor Dalton McGuinty make?
Well, we've talked a lot in this election and in the last 16 months about mistakes that were made, and I was part of that government. I've never tried to pretend that I wasn't. I mean, I have a lot of pride in the accomplishments that we were able to see in that period of time. But there were mistakes made, and I think that there's been a lot of discussion around the relocation of the gas plants and the oversight of some of the agencies. And what I've done for the last 16 months is work to correct those, you know, work to correct them and work to learn from them so that the same issues don't happen again.
You mentioned the gas plants. The OPP are still investigating that decision.
Right.
But you've rejected calls for a public inquiry. Why is that?
So there are a couple of things that were going on. There is an investigation ongoing, and that will unfold. There was a committee that saw tens of witnesses, I think 90 witnesses or so, and looked at hundreds of thousands of documents. That committee never got the opportunity to write a report. What I committed to during the election campaign is recalling that committee, getting that report written, getting the advice of that committee, and I think that's the process that needs to be concluded.
You enjoyed a lot of support from union members during the campaign. I mean, they were on the ground for you. What do you think that they're expecting in return for all that support?
I believe that the business community is expecting stability and fairness from us, and I think that the labor movement and organized labor is expecting fairness from us. And that's why when I say that I'm committed to a fair collective bargaining process, that's exactly what I mean. But everyone in every public sector union knows that our plan does not include increases to wages and salaries. So it's with eyes wide open that that we got the support that we got from across the political spectrum.
Listen, let me ask you this. And you started the campaign and you came out swinging at Stephen Harper about how he has mistreated the province of Ontario. And they have returned fire during the campaign. Now you have to work together. There's a lot of files, obviously, where there's common interests. How are you going to repair that relationship?
Well, so here's the thing. At the beginning of the campaign and throughout the campaign, we talked about the retirement pension plan. And on that file, Stephen Harper and I have had a disagreement from the time that he indicated, well before the election, that he was not interested in supporting an enhancement to the Canada Pension Plan. I think that's the wrong decision, you know, and there are leaders across this country that think that that is the wrong decision. So it's not so much that I came out swinging against Stephen Harper, it's that a fundamental cornerstone of our plan is to make sure that people have a decent retirement and that they have some security when they're finished with their work life, and he's not interested in making the enhancements that would allow that to be the case. So we are going to introduce an Ontario retirement pension plan. But there are other files that I hope we will be able to work together on very well. So I hope that that we can work together as we have in the past, whether it's been on the auto file, you know, we've worked together on the auto file, that we'll be able to work together in the best interest of the people of the country.
You're the first elected premier, a female premier in Ontario, excuse me. Do you feel like you stand for something bigger?
Well, the historians will weigh in on that. But I think it's very important that we work always to have an inclusive political process, you know, that everyone who lives in this province can see themselves reflected in some way in the decisions that are made by government and in the people who represent them. We have some way to go, but I think it is significant that young girls and parents say this to me all the time. They come up to me and they say, you know, I'm so excited that you're there, and my little girls can see that they can be the premier if they want to be. There's been no question about little boys having that possibility in their lives. So yeah, I think it is significant, and I will do everything I can to live up to the expectations of being a good premier as well as a female premier.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Maclean senior correspondent Jonathan Gatehouse speaking with Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne. To listen to the full interview, head to macleans.ca, or to read about it, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine.
This week, the Parliamentary Budget Officer released his report on federal transfers to the provinces, and it looks like Ontario is the big loser. The PBO found that Ontario will lose $1.2 billion in equalization payments this year, while a province like Alberta is set to take in an additional $1.1 billion.
The money moves are in part due to changes made to the transfer program by the Harper government. To talk more about the report, Maclean's political editor Paul Wells sits down with the Assistant Parliamentary Budget Officer Mustafa Askari.
The latest report is interesting because it talks about big numbers. It talks about the transfer system in Canada, which is where a very large amount of all federal spending goes. Has this office looked at the transfer system before?
No, not in detail. I mean, we have always thought that this is an interesting part of the government spending program, but we never really had the time and the resources to actually look at this, and given the complexity of especially the equalization part.
What we've seen is that recent changes in the programs lead to changes in the amount that provinces get that amount to many hundreds of millions of dollars, in some cases more than $1 billion. For instance, the headlines that came out on the day that the report came out is that Ontario loses $1.2 billion in equalization. Is that because the system is designed to get Ontario, or just because Ontario is doing better? How does that happen?
Well, part of that $1.2 billion decline in equalization is because Ontario is doing better. I mean, they're better in the sense that their fiscal capacity has done better than other receiving provinces. So obviously their equalization entitlement will decline because of that. But it's not all because of that. What the government has done is that they also have put a cap on the overall envelope of the equalization payment, which is tied to their growth in GDP. What that does is that once the entitlements are calculated and they add up to something above that cap that they have, yeah, then they have to bring everybody down. And so what it means is that you're going to get a hit, and that's where the Ontario got a big hit on because of that growth cap. So it's a combination of different aspects of the program that has resulted in Ontario essentially getting a decline in their transfer payment, whereas every other province actually saw an increase.
Okay. Yeah. So that growth cap is designed, it's not designed to increase the fairness or the transparency of the equalization system. It's designed to protect Ottawa against having to pay out too much more from one year to the next.
Exactly. It brings in a sort of a stability in the transfer payment from the federal perspective, because it's tied to GDP growth. So it's obviously never going to get out of hand in that sense. So it's to protect the federal government. But what it does, to me, what it does is that it moves the whole equalization program away from being an equalization program to just a transfer program, because the initial idea of the equalization, Section 36.2, that, you know, we'll have to provide the provinces with enough resources that they can provide comparable public services to the Canadian, you move away from that.
It's one of a few things in the total transfer system that look a little bit arbitrary. Another one that struck me is total transfer protection. That was something that was introduced in 2010 to make sure that a province didn't lose from one year to the next in the total amount of transfers and equalization that it received. This year, 4 years later, that protection comes off. And the only province that's hurt is Ontario. What rhyme or reason explains that?
There is really no reason for that. I mean, when they introduced that, of course, it was in the beginning of the recession. So the justification at the time was that they want to make sure that the provinces do not suffer through the recession. So they're providing that protection. Now, there was no plan for when that protection is going to come off. And it was just decided, and the provinces were informed in December 2013 when they got their allocation. So it was a surprise, specifically to Ontario.
And then there's one other change that was announced quite a long time ago, the change in the distribution of the Canada Health Transfer.
Exactly.
And here the big beneficiary is Alberta, whose Canada Health Transfer goes up 38%, while other provinces goes up only 2 or 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
And again, how come?
Well, I think they made a decision in 2007 that, as far as the health transfers are concerned, all Canadians should be treated the same way. So that's why they went on the cash per capita, equal per capita cash basis. Whereas before that, it was equal per capita cash and tax points transfer basis. And because the have-not provinces had a lower tax points transfer values, their cash payments would be larger. Now that they have gone to the only cash base, equal cash base, obviously you see a sudden increase in Alberta's per capita cash payment, and much less for the other provinces. Now that change, of course, will not be seen next year, because next year, essentially, there is really no change in the system. But for this year, that's correct. There's a significant increase in Alberta's allocation and not as much for the other ones.
Taken all together, the big changes this year are Ontario loses about a bit more than $1 billion. Quebec loses about a little bit more than $500 million. And Alberta gains a bit more than $1 billion, all for different reasons. But that's a pretty good summing up.
Yeah, I mean Quebec still gets an increase in equalization payments, mm-hmm. despite all that changes. But the increase that is less than what they would have gotten had they not been subject to those caps that the government had introduced.
Okay. Yeah. It's a peculiar situation where one of the largest spending items of any federal government and one of the largest revenue sources of any provincial government is so open to improvisation from year to year and so hard to understand for the average taxpayer. Is there any way to change that?
I think they can change some aspects of the program, design of the program, to make sure that they're more predictable for the provinces. Because I think part of the problem is that provinces have to make plans mm-hmm. in their budget. And this is a major part of the source of the revenue for them. And to me, the stability of the program, predictability of the program, and all the transfers together actually would be beneficial to all the provinces.
That was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Assistant Parliamentary Budget Officer Mustafa Askari.
Coming up, the Maclean's panel takes a look at the issues that define the spring sitting of Parliament, and we take a look at all the action in the last week of the House of Commons.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm City News and Rogers Radio Bureau Chief Cormac McSweeney, joined by my co-host, the Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine, Aaron Wary, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So MPs on Friday agreed to rise for the summer, and they won't be coming back until September 15th, but it was one heck of a spring sitting. We have a lot to talk about. It seems like every party had an issue pop up. We had the Prime Minister's office versus the Supreme Court, NDP mailings, new prostitution laws, controversial election reforms, privacy issues, Justin Trudeau on abortion, unfortunately the untimely death of former Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, and then we also had veterans issues with Veterans Affairs Minister Julian Fantino. A lot to talk about. First off, John, what were your impressions of the spring sitting?
I was surprised by a couple things I could never have imagined. You know, controversies over policy, over government programs, that's you know, the normal fodder of day-to-day life here. But a clash between the Prime Minister's office and the Supreme Court of Canada, like we saw, that's not foreseeable in any context. I've never seen anything like it. And in a way, even though I don't think the fallout of it may end up, and I'm not sure how it carries into the future as an important thing, just as a juncture, as an episode, I think it was historic. And if it tells us anything bigger, it tells us that there are people in the Prime Minister's office who are really ready to scrap with just about anyone, and that, I think, is worth keeping in mind. So of all the things that happened, that was the one that I'm still most taken aback by.
Aaron, what were your impressions?
I think it was an exhausting spring. I think there was a lot there in terms of issues that came up, and I think it was a rather exhausting approach to things. I think, you know, you look at the Fair Elections Act, which maybe was always going to be a point of some debate, but became such an exhausting slugfest that included, you know, so much on both sides in terms of debate and fight and all of the procedural games and that. There were so many issues on the table this spring, and so much stuff really that had to be debated. And I think it was a real sort of knockdown, drag out spring, which in many ways is nice and good. There's lots of issues to be debated. But at the same time, you know, I think we maybe have exhausted ourselves.
Is it me or is the Harper government being a little bit more daring with some of the legislation they brought forward when it comes to prostitution, election reforms, privacy issues? They're bringing forward legislation that they know the opposition is going to be up in arms about, more so than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I think prostitution is an interesting one, because I think most people thought the government was caught between a rock and a hard place there. it's complicated, but essentially the Supreme Court seemed to be signaling, hey, you've got to make it possible for prostitutes to work in a safer way. And the questions going into that week that that legislation was announced were all, how will they do this? How will they do this? In the end, they didn't do it. They made it, if anything, harder, probably considerably harder for prostitutes to work. But they also adjusted the overarching goals of the act. They switched it from being an act about nuisance and public disorder to being one about inequality, injustice, and human dignity, and possibly made the bill charter-proof in some kind of future court challenge as a result of that. So this is pretty interesting. It was craftily designed legislation.
Aaron, your thoughts on the legislation overall that was brought forward?
Comprehensive, I think, is a word to describe it. Complex, difficult, challenging. Not to get all philosophical, I'll be the philosophical one on the table. In the middle of this sitting, we had a book called Tragedy in the Commons come out that basically said the way things are running up here aren't running, they aren't working. And we have spent sort of the last few months chewing over big issues and seeing how big issues are hashed out. And I think there's a good question to be asked about whether they're hashed out well enough. You look at the Temporary Foreign Workers Program, and I would wonder personally, well, why didn't we have committee hearings through the spring? Why wasn't this an issue that was being hashed over at committee and solutions were being tossed around? The prostitution bill, there's all these concerns about the constitutionality of it. Well, why don't we have a legal opinion? Why isn't the Justice Department releasing a legal opinion that gets to that? The F-35, apparently the government has a report on it, but won't release that report. Well, why don't we release that report and have a debate about it?
Or until after the facts are in.
Yeah.
They'll let us know the facts after they've already made an probably irrevocable decision.
Exactly. So, you look at that, and I come back to the Fair Elections Act. So we had a really big public debate about it, and that, in some way, is a good thing. There should be debate about these things, and there should be very strong debate about it. But why didn't the minister consult with the chief electoral officer? Why didn't he consult with Harry Neufeld? Why wasn't there an attempt to make this a bipartisan effort? As much as this session was about really serious legislation, maybe there's a secondary discussion, which is, how do we deal with these serious issues?
All right, and then just briefly moving forward over the months ahead, over the summer and then into the fall, what are you looking for, John?
Two things, more than any other FOSS. I want to see what they do in the F-35 fighter jet procurement, whether they actually do ditch that, what has turned out to be a fiasco of a program and go with an open competition for jets, or whether they find a way to justify going ahead with the F-35 or Joint Strike Fighter. That's one. The other is, are they going to get a deal in the Canada-EU trade negotiations? The Prime Minister went to Brussels, jetted to Brussels with much fanfare last fall to announce an agreement in principle. I'm starting to think maybe he should have hung out a mission accomplished banner at that event, because we're still more than eight months later, we don't have a deal. So that's starting to look like a pretty hollow photo op if he doesn't pretty soon put a final deal on the table.
Like the reference to the Bush mission accomplished banner over the situation
in Iraq.
You're
right. It could be seen that way, would I say.
Yeah. And Aaron, what are you looking for?
A couple of things. First, the by-elections at the end of this month, primarily in Trinity Spadina, but also a bit secondary in Scarborough. I think that's a big test for the Liberals and the New Democrats in terms of who's winning that battle for the kind of alternative to Stephen Harper. The second thing is, I think the environment debate, as much as it maybe has been stagnant or it hasn't seemed to be moving forward, we're now kind of getting to a point where it's got to move forward. And going into 2015, I think there could be a real serious debate there about, are we going to do anything? If we are going to do anything, what are we going to do?
All right. Thank you very much again to Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and my co-host, Maclean's Associate Editor Aaron Wherry.
And now it's time for our question period and review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
A pipeline called Northern Gateway absolutely obsessed the opposition this week. The Tories conditionally approved the pipeline earlier this week, though they refused to use such strong language, if conditional approval is strong language, in the House of Commons. The NDP mustered all the strength of its BC caucus to challenge that decision. Before Gateway took the spotlight, Peter MacKay preoccupied the House with comments he made about a recent Tory appointment to Quebec's Court of Appeal. He initially slipped during question period and spoke of Robert Mainville as if he'd been appointed to Canada's top court.
He's been a member of the Quebec Bar, Mr. Speaker, for 33 years and sat as a federal court judge for 5 years. I believe his wealth of legal knowledge will be welcome at the Supreme Court and will be of significant benefit to the Quebec Court of Appeal.
On Tuesday, the opposition made its final pleas to the government on the BC pipeline that would get the go-ahead later that day. Here's Liberal leader Justin Trudeau.
On the north coast of BC, people make their living on the water. Will the Prime Minister protect the BC economy and say no to the Northern Gateway pipeline?
On Wednesday, NDP leader Tom Mulcair stared down BC Tories and dared any of them to openly reject a pipeline he says their province doesn't want.
3 years, the Prime Minister and his cabinet have been out there shilling for the Northern Gateway pipeline, saying it was of vital interest. Now not a single Conservative minister is available to explain the decision to Canadians. So, if no BC Conservatives will defend this decision, will the Prime Minister please explain to us why approving this pipeline is worth putting 45,000 British Columbia coastal jobs at risk?
The Tories had their talking points down pat by Thursday. Parliamentary Secretary Kelly Block insisted that the government didn't give a thumbs up to Northern Gateway and that Enbridge has a lot of work left to do to make its case.
Projects will only move forward if they are safe for Canadians and safe for the environment. Our decision is based on the conclusions of an independent, science-based review panel.
Just as the debate over Enbridge's controversial pipeline reaches a fever pitch in the Commons, parliamentarians vacate the chamber for the summer. It's time for a change of scenery. And for BC MPs, it's time to continue their pipeline fight closer to home.
Once again, with Question Period and Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.